You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
You're listening to The Archaeology Show. TAS goes behind the headlines to bring you the real stories about archaeology and the history around us. Welcome to the podcast.
Hello and welcome to The Archaeology Show, episode 3.14159265.... repeating.
On today's show, if you haven't guessed already, we talk about pie. P-I-E. P-I and P-Y-E.
Let's dig a little deeper and get our hands in that pie.
How many decimal places do you think we can go to?
I mean, you can go infinitely. Realistically, there's no pattern.
The infinite show.
The infinite show. We're just going to do numbers for the rest of the show.
Oh, God, no.
Welcome to the show, everybody.
Hello.
So let's start with RV stuff, since my recent perusal of... Apple and Spotify reviews show how much people actually love that.
Or also not love it, but that's fine.
I mean, I feel like negative reviews are often like Yelp reviews and Google reviews and TripAdvisor reviews. It's the people who are disgruntled that go in and type that review out.
I know. I like always take negative reviews with a grain of salt.
Yeah.
So we're just going to keep doing our RV travels at the beginning of our archaeology and history podcast. There you go.
Yes. So... just real quick. Well, first off, go leave a review if you like what we're doing.
We would love to get some more reviews and from people who clearly give us more of a try than just like half an episode and then decide they hate us.
Yeah.
Because like that definitely happens. And it's like, you didn't even try. Anyway.
So where we're at right now is a place called Mazayadin Lake.
Yes. It's gorgeous. Yeah. We have been here for, man, going on a week now.
Yep.
Hasn't it? That's crazy. We never spend that long in one place. But, you know, we...
not this summer anyway.
Not this summer. Yeah. Because we've been moving quickly to get around Alaska and Canada. But we got here and we snagged a lakefront spot from the first come first serve spots at this campground. And it's just gorgeous. I've been paddleboarding every day. We've seen tons of bears. It's been great.
There hasn't been any wind. This whole entire lake is glass.
It's sunny and beautiful and like warm, but not so warm that you want to die. So
the lake is a good temperature. It's about in the 70s, which is... chilly for your body because it's below your body temperature, but it's not cold.
Yeah, honestly.
It's not like Tahoe cold.
No, definitely not. Yeah. It's been gorgeous.
It's been really nice. And with the bears, I mean, people drive around to different places to see bears where there's known hangouts, but the park rangers in this park are really diligent about either watching for people running to take pictures. They know there's a bear around.
Yeah.
Because the bears just come through and then they fire these horn blasts. And if they fire three of them, it means get inside of your rigs because...
yeah.
You know, there's bears in the park. And then they have these rubber bullet guns. I don't know if they're handguns or shotguns, actually, or like rifles. I haven't actually seen them.
I think they're more like handguns. And I heard somebody call it a bear blaster.
Well, they've got these rubber bullets to give active deterrence. So the bears are like, that's a bad place to go.
Just send them out of the park.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So anyway, it's pretty cool. Nice place. We're leaving tomorrow as we're recording right now and still making our way down BC.
Yep. Yeah. Really enjoying this beautiful province. I know it's gorgeous here and we've loved spending these couple weeks and it just makes me want to spend more time here. So one of these days
of the provinces in Canada, unlike Alberta, it's really mountainous here. We like it.
Call back to an old episode where we messed that one up. Please don't come for us again.
I didn't. By percentage, Alberta's flat. Fight me. I don't care.
I'm going to cut all this out when all I edit it. I really don't want Canadians coming for us again.
Canada has been amazing, though. It's been really awesome.
Beautiful. Yeah. I love it here so much.
Yeah.
And the exchange rate doesn't hurt.
No. When you're spending American dollars here, which we try to just because we like to, you know, support local.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
But yeah, we get like a 30% discount.
Yes. Yeah, that has been really nice for... if you're wondering where to go as an American tourist where you're going to get, you know, some value for your dollar... Canada is a really good place right now. It's easy to get to and it's a beautiful country. So,
yep, for sure.
Anyway.
All right. What's also beautiful are pies.
Pies.
Yes. So we're going to talk about pies today.
Yeah.
Both numbers and foods.
Might sound random, but take a look at your screen right now and see what the episode number is.
Yes. It's 314.
Yep.
3.14 for you non-math nerds is pi, the variable or constant, I should say, known as pi.
Yeah. And you might think that we would do an episode like this on, you know, March 14th, Pi Day. Nah, we don't roll like that. We're not going to do what everybody else does, obviously.
I know. We don't really pay attention to calendar stuff too often.
No, we miss when it stuff rolls like around. That.
Yeah. That requires planning.
Yeah. We'd have to be like way far ahead.
No. Right.
But this did come up and we were like, Well, that would be a fun topic to do, is cover pie across history and throughout history.
Yeah.
Because that's our episode number, sort of.
So the way we're going to do this, because this is somewhat chronological, mm-hmm. although that's, like all things in history and archaeology, debatable, we're going to cover the origin and history of fruit pies mm-hmm. in segment one. And then we're going to jump to the number pie, its discovery and use. And then the last segment will be the history and origin of meat pies.
And yes. I might have done a little side research on a little like extra thing that I'll surprise you with near the end,
oh,
too.
Oh, my. Okay. Well, let's go back to, like, if you had to guess where pies started, like who was making stuff into crusts?
Yeah.
And putting in there. Like, I mean,
you know, it's got to be one of three, right? It's either the Egyptians, the Greeks, or the Romans.
Right.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, they're kind of the ones.
Yeah. The big ones.
It's the Egyptians.
Yes.
So that's where we're going to start. Archaeologists have found pastries stuffed with honey in tombs dating to around 2000 BCE, which are imagined as the world's first fruit pies and offerings for the afterlife. So it's basically things stuffed in pastries.
Yeah.
Is considered like kind dope, of pie. Basically. Right.
Yeah.
When we say pies in this context, we don't necessarily mean like a pie tin.
Yeah.
You know, a round pie.
It's not like your American, right. you know, pie situation.
Right.
I didn't mean to reference the movie, but yes, like that kind of pie. So the Greeks then took a step further and they made simple doughs filled with fruit and nuts. And they didn't call them pies, but the concept was there, of course.
Yeah.
And again, this is like a, it's a filling, right? So it sounds like it's more of an all enclosed type of a thing. But, you know, I guess like a hand pie is still a version of pie. So
yeah.
Then the Romans came along and they borrowed from the Greeks' idea, of course, because, you know, that's what they did.
Yep.
And they started wrapping fruits and meats in pastry. And at Pompeii, we know this because at Pompeii, researchers have found carbonized remains of what look like ancient pie crusts, which totally makes sense because sometimes the crust be a little thick, right? And so if you don't want to eat that whole thing, you might just toss it in the fire. Yep. And then there it goes to stay forever for archaeologists to uncover later. That's, I love that little detail.
Yeah. So archaeological digs at sites like York in medieval England, well, when York was in medieval England, but, you know, mm-hmm. archaeological digs recently have pies. And of course, it's medieval language. So it's spelled P-Y-E-S mm-hmm. in historical texts. But they show up in cookbooks
yeah.
and on feasting tables.
Yeah.
And they uncovered pie molds and ovens used to bake these early pies.
Mm-hmm.
Some early pie crusts, and I love this, were called yes. coffins.
Yes.
C-O-F-F-Y-N-S.
Yeah.
They were thick and tough and not meant to be eaten. They were preservation.
Yeah.
Yeah. They would just keep the filling safe. Some of these crusts have been found in kitchen middens and basically, which are basically ancient trash heaps. So
yeah.
that's what a midden is.
Kind of like the Romans, maybe yeah. tossing their crust into the fire. But in this case, they made them thick on purpose. That's just so crazy to me, right?
Yeah.
I think it's partly crazy because today when you think of a pie, like for me personally, kind of the crust is the best part. Like you want that like flaky, buttery, doughy crust, but they weren't trying to make a delicious crust back then. They were trying to preserve the inside so that they would have something decent to eat later on down the road whenever they were meant to eat it. That's really cool.
Yep.
But a little sad because crust is
delicious. Yes. In 1381, we have the first recorded fruit pie recipe. And this is, again, England, and it's for an apple pie.
Mm,
the book is
sense.
Called, yeah, The Form of Curry, and it's C-U-R-Y. And I don't think they were talking about curry like it's super huge in England now.
No, because that has two R's in it, and it's Indian.
Well, yeah, but this is an older spelling.
Yeah.
And obviously, they weren't talking about Indian curry, but
no.
I think it's just ironic that there was a cookbook called The Form of Curry, and England, you
yeah.
know, with their association with India hundreds of years later, became almost famously known for curry.
Yeah, so, that is interesting.
Yeah. But anyway, sugar didn't really show up in European pies until the Renaissance when trade brought it in, which is another kind of crazy concept. Archaeological finds of sugar cones in port cities back this up, actually.
Crazy.
Yep.
Yeah, I guess sugar was a bit hard to come by until, you know, the trade and stuff
yeah.
got really going later on.
For sure. In America, colonial America, settlers brought their pie making skills and adapted them to local fruits using apples, berries, whatever they could find. Hearth excavations at Jamestown actually have turned up pie dishes and fruit seeds.
Yeah, that's a super interesting point because when you're looking for evidence of something, it's not only evidence of the actual thing, but you can look for evidence of the tools too. So knowing that they found pie dishes, which are very mm-hmm. clearly used for making a certain type of dish, well, then you know that dish was present in that place. So yeah, that's a cool little archaeology bit there.
Yeah. Another kind of interesting note too, is that people realized with this crust at some point, especially with the whole coffin thing, that pies could be, the pie concept anyway, with the crust and things inside of it, could be used as portable. So for people who want to take something with them and they don't really have a good lunchbox or, you know, something like that, portable food for workers and travelers. Archaeologists have found pie tins in mining camps and along pioneer trails. And of course, I mean, we had an episode when we were in Mexico about tacos. Tacos were kind of a result like
portable food.
Yeah, portable food.
Yeah.
And we've talked about the pasties.
Yeah.
Yeah, Cornish pasties, things like that. Those are all, I mean,
they're pies,
they're in the pie family.
Yeah. Well, tacos not so much, but pasties for sure.
Yeah. Well, some people do call them hand pies, actually.
Yeah, they do. Yeah.
So,
yeah.
If you've ever seen these little, like, birds, it was kind of a thing. It was like this little, like, a, either a dough shape on the top of the pie or like a raised up three-dimensional bird in the middle of a pie crust. They're called pie birds. And
I have no idea. This is like new information to me.
Yeah. I mean, you've probably seen pictures, just didn't really focus on it, but ceramic versions from the 18th century have popped up on digs on both sides of the Atlantic.
Okay. So again, another kind of tool sort of, so that you know that people were making pies, even if you don't have remains of the pies.
Pretty much.
So regional favorites like cherry pies in North America can often be traced through pollen and seed analysis in old kitchen sites.
Yeah.
Which makes sense. And we've talked about cherries specifically in North America at a couple of colonial era sites, I think, over the last couple of years. So of course they would be making pies, right?
From an interpretive standpoint, though, as an archaeologist, I would probably be cautious about saying, well, this was used for pie making, unless you have other pie making paraphernalia.
Yeah.
Because they could be making jam. They could be making, you know, well, they crush berries and do whatever they want.
They could just be eating the cherries. They don't have to be doing anything with them. Yeah.
Making cocktails.
Yeah.
We don't know.
Yeah. You have to be careful with that. Oh my gosh. They could have been making a drink, though. There's like a cherry cordial type thing that you could make.
Sure.
Yeah. By the 19th century, pie was everywhere in America, of course. And it's just like a classic today, right?
Yep.
Smithsonian researchers have traced the rise of pie through cookbooks and the spread of pie dishes in households.
There you go.
And even at county fairs, pie contests are a thing. This I thought was really cool. Archaeologists have found prize ribbons and pie plates at fairgrounds from the late 1800s.
Yes.
So grandma's been baking her homemade special recipe pie for, you know, over 100 years at this point.
Right. Yeah, the industrial age made pie mass-produced. Brands like Hostess left behind a trail of packaging, tins, and even advertising posters, which are now artifacts in their own right.
Kind of crazy, right?
Yeah.
But yeah.
Yeah, archaeobotanists are still analyzing charred pie crusts and fruit residues from ancient hearths, piecing together what people ate thousands of years ago.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Pies are a thing. People love pies. In fact, the phrase, as American as apple pie, is so crazy because it's not really, I mean, not really American at all. The first pie recipe was an apple pie from England in 1381.
Right. But it has gotten pretty synonymous with America.
Which is crazy.
It is crazy.
There aren't even apples everywhere. Is that the most dominant fruit? I mean, it's not even.
I don't know.
I wouldn't think.
It's just the perfect combination of flavors, in my opinion.
Don't get me wrong. I love an apple pie.
Yeah.
I don't know how it became synonymous with American, though.
Yeah.
That's crazy.
Yeah. Crazy. It's kind of like that other phrase. Easy as pie too, because pies are really easy to make. And I think this is another reason why they are synonymous with, you know, many cultures throughout the world.
Yeah.
They're just easy to do. And it uses a lot of really, it's like good nutrition too. So well, kind of good nutrition, depending on how much sugar you use, but you know.
All right. Well, on the other side of the break, we're going to talk about numbers and math a little bit. So if you don't like it, hit your 30-second skip button about 15 times or 30 times. And we'll see.
I think I'm going to skip. I'm going to hit the skip on that.
I don't think you can hit the skip. All right. See you on the other side. Welcome back to the pie episode of the Archaeology Show.
It's pie day.
It's pie day.
I feel like we need to like make a pie now or something.
100% need to make a pie.
Yeah. I could probably make a pie. I've got some frozen berries and frozen crusts. I could do it.
I would like a chicken pot pie.
Oh, that's a different kind of pie. I don't think I have all those ingredients.
All right. Well, the first people to get curious about circles, which I have no doubt. Well, the funny thing is the pi is a Greek letter.
Yes.
And a pie, P-I-E, is a round pastry that we know today. But although, as we said in the last segment, they've been in different shapes and things.
Yeah.
It's just so funny to me that they're related.
Yeah.
And I think that's a coincidence.
It is a coincidence, I think. Yeah. Total coincidence, but we're here for it. And we're just going to link them together as if they were purposely related, yeah. even though they're not.
I know. So back to what I was saying, the first people to get curious about circles and kind of how they work were, again, the ancient Egyptians.
Yeah.
I mean, they were trying to build huge buildings and stuff, and they had to really kind of start figuring some mm-hmm. math out mm-hmm. to make it all work out.
Yep.
But there's a thing called the Rhind Mathematical Papyrus, and it was found by Egyptologists. Mm-hmm. And it shows that they got surprisingly close to pi, which, again, is 3.14 repeating. It's yeah. not a predictable number.
Yeah.
But they got 3.1605.
Pretty close.
It's documented. Yeah.
Pretty close.
That Rhind Mathematical Papyrus, what font do you think that was written in?
Oh, my.
I don't know.
No.
Times New Roman, maybe?
No. Oh, my God. That's ridiculous. Okay, over in Mesopotamia, clay tablets from Babylon, which are now in a collection in Yale, show that they used 3.125 for pi. And they were probably using that for buildings, making pottery, anything where they needed to, you know, get yep. that shape correct. So yep. still close, but not quite exactly it yet.
Yep. The Bible even hints at pi. There's a little bit of math in there, I guess, with the description of, I know, Solomon's basin in 1 Kings. Just a rough estimate of 3. I'm like, was that 3, what, 3 cubits?
3.
Now we go to ancient Greece, of course, with Archimedes. And Archimedes was a big inventor, mathematician. He mm-hmm. did all kinds of stuff. Mm-hmm. He was working in Syracuse and used polygons to get pi between 3 and 1/7 and 3 and 1071/71.
Yeah.
How do you say that? 71st. Fragments of his writings have been found in ancient libraries.
So he got it the closest to date, basically.
Yeah. Yeah.
So then we go to the Far East and we get Chinese mathematician Zhu Chongzi in the 5th century. And he pushed pi to 7 decimal places. Ancient Chinese texts and counting rods have been excavated that show this advanced math that they were using to get to that place.
Yeah. I just wonder if 1,000 years ago, 1,500 years ago, we could have gotten all the smart people of the world together.
I know.
You know, like, where would we be today?
Right.
If we'd done that.
Maybe they would have figured out how to make gold out of nothing.
Oh, maybe. They tried.
They sure did.
That was kind of random.
My thought process was, like, you get a bunch of really smart people in a room together. You can't always, like, push them the direction you want them to go. And so, like, what happens if they, like, zero in on a pseudoscience mm-hmm. instead of on a real science? Because science was in its infancy back then, right? Yeah. So they might have just gone down the, you know, alchemy route
yeah.
and tried to make gold instead of, like, doing things like creating pi and all the other, like, awesome mathematical things yeah. that some of these individuals did. That's what happened in my brain right there. I guess I should have explained that.
I know. It's either money or war. That's what it's used for. Archimedes made a lot of war engines.
Yes. Yeah. True. Yeah. So very true.
Well, over to India, because a lot of smart people over there mm-hmm. and they invented a lot of different things that we have today. But a person named Aryabhata in India got pi to 3.1416, which is about as close as you can get right mm-hmm. now. His work survives on ancient palm leaf manuscripts. And one common theme here amongst all these older people, even from, you know, centuries ago, they're documenting everything.
Yeah.
They knew the importance.
But it's not even the importance. Like, when you're working with numbers, you have to write stuff down because your brain can't keep it in your head, you know?
But I'm sure they had, like, if they had the ability to write stuff down in some way on something, I'm sure mm-hmm. they had, like, you know, their version of scratch paper, where they were working yeah. all this stuff out and yeah. then officially documented it. And, you know, we talk about that as, you know, we write up papers and things like that today as sort of the official record
True.
Of research. Yeah. And I just love that that's an ancient tradition.
Yeah, I guess it would have to be because yeah. it's, you know, if you want people to adopt this, you have to kind of prove that it works. And to do that, yeah. you need an official writing about it.
Now, of course, we have to jump over to the Islamic world because they were heavy into math.
Yes,
yeah, heavy much. Into math. The Islamic Golden Age was a time when mathematicians like Al-Khwarizmi, I think it's Khwarizmi, refined pi even further. Archaeological digs in Baghdad have unearthed manuscripts and mathematical instruments. It's a real shame with all the conflicts in the Middle East because I just know that stuff is getting destroyed.
Yeah.
And, you know, archaeological research is on hold in a lot of places. And
yeah.
it's just, there's so much there, though.
Yeah.
Yep.
So the symbol for pi itself, which would be the, you know, the little Stonehenge symbol.
Yep. Nice.
That's technical. Didn't show up until 1706. And that was thanks to William Jones. And it was really like a big, you know, jump in mathematical shorthand to come up with an idea like that, to have a symbol represent a number rather than having to write out the whole thing every time. It's a constant, like we've said a couple times. So like, you don't need to write that out every single time. The symbol can represent it instead. And that made doing math stuff with it even easier.
So, yeah, I mean, we wrote these notes down, but I don't think I put it together until just saying all this at the same time. Maybe he chose that symbol because it was the Greek letter for pi. And by 1706, they certainly would have had a lot of pi.
Maybe. Yeah.
You know, so maybe he chose that purposely because it represents circles and what the familiar circle people might have.
Yeah.
You know,
it's entirely possible that they're related in some way.
Yeah. Because there is no Greek letter that directly translates to like wheel.
Right.
Or circle even.
Yeah.
You know, the Greek letter pi is literally pronounced pi.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Mm-hmm. Anyway, archaeologists have found circular stone foundations and pottery bases across the ancient world, suggesting that builders had to understand the relationship between diameter and circumference, which is basically pi in practice. I mean, you can make a circle without knowing what pi is, but if you want to make it and do other things with it and make this repeatable and replicatable from a building standpoint, you do kind of have to have some understanding, even if you don't know what to call it.
Yeah. And it does need to be the correct proportion, right? Like that's what it's all about. If you're trying to make a tower or something, you know, you've got to have pi involved so that you get the right circumference and the right, and everything is in the right place, you know?
Yeah. And things like compasses and rulers. So a compass, not like a north, south, east, west compass, directional compass, but like a measuring compass with the two points that, you know, look like chopsticks on the end.
You put the thing in the middle and then the outer on the other end draws the circle.
Yeah, things like that. And again, marked sticks, essentially rulers, yardsticks, meter sticks, that kind of thing, of that kind of size, turn up in digs from Egypt to Greece, hinting at how ancient people just worked with circles and knew what they were doing.
And that is interesting too, because you can use a circle drawing compass without having any idea what pi is or what it does. All you know you're doing is that you're drawing a perfect circle, you know? So that interesting that it makes sense that we would have evidence of those tools way older than we have of people actually refining the number into the mathematical constant that it is today.
I mean, where the understanding of pi comes into play really is, again, you don't need pi to draw a circle.
Right.
But where it comes into play is understanding how to find the circumference of a circle or building materials or the area of a circle, you know, or something like that. Again, for building materials, even like the area of a sphere.
Yeah.
You know, stuff like that. So they had to, if they wanted to know accurate numbers.
Yeah. Like all those beautiful ancient domes that are out there, they had to use pi in order to get those not only built correctly, but built safely in a way that they weren't going to fall down, you know?
Yep. Coins even and standard weights from ancient markets show evidence of circular geometry, which is sort of another you know, hint at pi's use.
Yeah. Ancient navigation, of course, would have relied on pi for mapping and calculating distances. And we have archaeological finds of astrolabes and maps that back this up. Yep.
Today, archaeologists and historians are still uncovering clay tablets and tools showing how widespread and important pi was and still is in human history. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think one of the most interesting things to take away from this segment is that it was developed. Pi, the constant, was developed independently across multiple cultures around the world. So now some of these scholars might have been speaking to each other if they were contemporaneous in some way. But I mean, I don't think that Archimedes was speaking with, you know, Islamic scholars or Chinese scholars, you know. So this developed independently and all these different cultures used it to build buildings, which I think is the most amazing piece of it. It wasn't some single individual who did this and spread it around the world. It was everybody. Saw how important it was and figured out how to use it, which is just really cool.
Yeah.
Human ingenuity right there, right?
And future archaeologists will uncover Texas Instruments calculators like the TI-85, TI-86. I had the 86 when I was growing up.
I just had an 83. Yeah. I was not that advanced in math.
Yeah. Well, it's funny because I remember I don't have one in front of me, although I do think I have one in storage. I never got rid of it. But anyway, I don't have one in front of me, but I'm pretty sure pi is one of the few constants that's a button right on the calculator.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure it is. Yeah. So, oh, man, I hate the calculator.
If you look at if you've got an iPhone, I don't know about Android, probably, but if you look at your iPhone and you rotate it sideways when you have the calculator turned on, it turns into the scientific calculator.
Yeah.
Or you can use a setting to do that. And I'm pretty sure pi is a constant button on there as well.
Oh, I think it is. Yeah. Yeah. So, very cool.
Yep. All right. Well, we're going back to food and we're going to talk about meat pies. And you try to think about where our first place we're going to go to with meat pies is. I mean, I know what I would have thought it would be, and it's not what I thought it would be.
Okay.
So we'll talk about that on the other side. Welcome back to episode 3.141612. So I don't know if that's right.
I think that's probably pretty close.
Pretty close, yeah. Of the archaeology show, we're talking about pies. So we're going to go back to food here with meat pies.
Yeah.
So, I mean, if you were looking at our notes and you were to think, what was the first culture area group to come up with meat pies? What do you think of?
I'm looking at our notes. So that's hard for me to say. What was in your brain?
England.
Oh.
Only because I just associate like medieval England and all the movies and stuff you watch, like, you know,
yeah,
Robin Hood and Braveheart and stuff like that are, you know, take place in those sort of time frames. There's meat pies everywhere.
Yeah. Well, you're thinking of Cornish pasties. Like that's
not just Cornish pasties, though. Like, yeah, you see these big feasting tables and it's just like they're digging in and it's like a pheasant pie or something like that, you know?
Yeah.
So I don't know. That's just what's in my head. And of course, they're not the first ones to do it.
No, because there was several cultures that predate them that came up with this concept.
Quite a few, actually.
Honestly, it's not that much different from the fruit pie discussion we had in segment one. Yeah. So ancient Egypt, of course, was the oldest.
Yeah.
And they didn't just do fruit pies. They did meat pastries, too. And we know this because there are tomb paintings that show them. And also there are some food remains in tombs that show that meat filled dough was a definite component of their diets.
Yeah. I mean, everybody loves a good crust.
I know.
And I'm just wondering how the crust was wore back there, because I feel like they were probably pretty tough.
They might have been pretty solid piece of crust. But like we talked about, though, it might have been more of a container than the food itself, you know? So makes sense.
Like, I'm not trying to bring religion in this, but what is the Catholic Church doing when they're canonizing these people that do other things? And like, I don't even know who the saint of puff pastry is. Like, whoever invented that needs to just be a saint.
I feel like that was definitely the French, right? Didn't they make puff pastry?
I would assume.
We didn't look that one up specifically.
No. Yeah. I mean, you can't do anything bad. You can just roll out puff pastry and put anything in it. It's going to be delicious.
And it's going to be delicious. For sure. Yeah.
The Greeks baked meat in dough, calling them autokrios.
Yeah.
I'm making autokrios.
Yeah, me too. Let's do it.
Offerings to the gods sometimes included these savory pies, and remnants have been found in temple sites. I mean, did they not get down on some of these, though?
Well, but if it was an offering, you wouldn't have eaten it.
Not the offering, but it's like, okay, three for the god, one for me. Let's just like make these.
Oh, true. Although if that were the case, you wouldn't find remnants of it because it would be in their bellies. Well, so
I'm going to assume they ate them.
Yeah, I would assume they probably did.
Yeah. But the Romans also loved their meat pies. And it was obviously they're traveling all over the place, especially the Roman armies. And we know that wartime and armies and military, they actually have to invent a lot of things that are beneficial to other humans.
Yep.
Just because of their weird circumstances.
Yeah, because they're constantly moving and they have to be able to transport the things that they're using.
Yeah, so they use these, as we've talked about with the fruit pies, to preserve and transport food. And in fact, in Pompeii, archaeologists have found a number of pie molds and even charred remains of pies in ovens.
Oh, that's so crazy. So like Pompeii happened and like there was literally a pie in the oven and they ran out and just left it there. Yeah. And they find that is like, that would be the coolest find ever. I love those snapshots of everyday life, right? Yeah. Because you don't really know what ancient people are doing on the day to day. That's a hard thing to wrap your mind around just with what remains. I love Pompeii so much.
I know. Just thinking about what was happening at Pompeii when that, you know, eruption happened.
Yeah.
I mean, in ancient life in a big city with really a lot of rich people, it was a wealthy city. A lot of travelers come there that were wealthy and things like that. And people live there. Mm-hmm. But there's no refrigerators.
Right.
Food is being cooked constantly.
Yeah, for sure.
I mean, constantly, every single day.
Yeah, especially in these big manors and houses that had a lot of people living in them. The thing that gets me, though, is that all the reading and research we've done about Pompeii says that it didn't happen in an hour or even a day. Yeah. It happened over the course of a couple days, and it took people a minute to like realize it was, you know, like they had some time to get up and get out. The ones that did get up and get out, not all of them did. So it is kind of crazy that a pie would have been left in the oven. But, you know, the circumstances, who knows what happened. Maybe they were trying to bake one last pie and just like couldn't get it done in time. Who knows?
This next point from medieval England says that pies were mostly savory, which is what I associate medieval England with.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. Cookbooks from the time and digs of kitchen sites reveal that pies with beef, game, or fish were common. Yeah. I don't know if I can get down on a fish pie.
Oh, I don't know. I bet you could. Yeah. If it was a really good like fish mixture, you know, think of like a smoked fish or something, that would be delicious.
Yeah. And this is where we see in like movies and stuff where some historical accuracy is going on there. But game pies, so, you know, like game animals.
Yeah.
Were a big deal for the rich. Excavations in manor houses sometimes turn up pie molds shaped like animals and used for elaborate feasts.
So decadent, right? Yeah. To like have enough money to have a pie baked in the shape of like a stag or something.
Yeah.
With the like meat from the deer that you hunt and killed. That's just so extra right there. But like, feels like medieval England a little bit.
I feel like I've seen this in some kind of movie too, where somebody puts a fork into the top of a pie crust and a bird pops out, because feasts sometimes did feature pies with live birds inside.
Like the song, like the nursery rhyme, sing a song, a sixpence pocket full of rye. When the pie was open, the birds begin to sing. Wasn't that a dainty dish?
Sure.
That's not the right words. I will. Okay. Hold on.
Okay. Rachel's looking that up. We're going to have it. But anyway, archaeological finds of giant pie dishes and banquet halls back up these stories of live birds and pies. And again, I'm sure they just like laid the crust over. I don't know how they got the bird to lay down until they brought the pie out, but maybe it was really hard crust.
Okay, I was right. It's sing a song of sixpence, pocket full of rye, 4 and 20 blackbirds baked in a pie. When the pie was open, the birds began to sing. Wasn't that a dainty dish to serve before the king?
Okay.
Have you never heard that, really?
I really don't think I have.
English nursery rhyme.
Yeah.
It talks about 4 and 20 blackbirds baked right in that thing.
I'm not old English or a nursery, so.
So awesome. But they, I mean, it was not like they murdered the bird. Well, maybe some of them did get murdered, probably. But it's a surprise entertainment that would have happened in this scenario. And it would have been like a hollow pastry lid and the pie would be cut and the birds would fly out. So,
yeah. What happens when you don't have Netflix? You bake live birds into a pie.
I know, man, it's just crazy that the things that people would have done for entertainment and so crazy.
Constantly bored, I bet, these rich people, because they're people have to constantly try to entertain them.
Yeah. And whoever came up with that idea was like, this is solid gold right here.
Yeah. But then the next time it was old news.
Yeah.
Like, ah, the birds again. They crapped everywhere last time.
Come on.
In colonial America, meat pies were also used and enjoyed, and they adapted to whatever was available. Pork, beef, wild game. Hearth excavations have turned up animal bones and pie dishes.
Mm-hmm. Again, those dishes, they will really tell you the story for real, right?
Yep.
And now we're going to talk about the Cornish pasty, of course, because we have talked about this a bunch of times, and also we personally love to eat them.
Yes, they're delicious.
They are so delicious. I need to learn how to make them.
The Cornish Pasty Company in Arizona. There's at least two locations I know of.
Yeah, those were so good.
So good.
And there's the one in Elko that we used to go to.
Oh, yeah. Yeah,
so good. But anyway, they have this thick crust handle. So basically, they would fill the crust, and then they would fold it over, and then they sort of twist or fold over the edge into this like rounded shape, and that becomes the handle because it's thicker right there.
Mm-hmm.
And it sounds like they didn't necessarily eat that thick handle crust because it was more for holding while they were eating, and then they would discard it. But today, that thick crust bit is like the best. It's like the best part of it. So.
Well, we don't have to handle it anymore. We'll generally put it on a plate.
Yes, true. Mm-hmm. So it doesn't need to be so solid anymore.
Yeah. Yep. As the British spread around the globe, so did their pies, of course. In Australia, there's 19th century street vendors that sold meat pies.
Mm-hmm.
Old pie tins have been found in city digs.
Yep. And let's not leave out Asia, of course. In Central Asia, archaeologists have uncovered ancient samsa, which are meat-filled pastries baked in clay ovens.
Nice. In Canada, Quebec's tortillere has roots in French colonial cooking.
Mm.
Old pie plates and recipe books have been found in settlements along the St. Lawrence River.
Well, that makes sense, of course, given the French influence there.
Yep.
The Industrial Revolution brought mass-produced pies, and archaeological finds include pie shop signs and pie molds from Victorian London.
Nice. Yep, there's archaeozoologists out there studying animal bones and charred pastry bits from ancient trash heaps, reconstructing what went into those early meat pies. That's some experimental archaeology I could get on board with.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. I love it. Experimental archaeology is one of my favorite things because people who are taking the time to, like, first off, pick through the trash of past peoples, be them ancient or just, you know, 100 years ago or 200 years ago.
Right.
Find the trash, figure out what these trash remains are, and then go find similar items and recreate whatever they think it might have been that they were making. Good for them. That's amazing. Yeah. I love it. I want to hear all about that research.
Yeah. For the working class, pies were cheap and filling. Pie shops popped up everywhere, all over the place, because, again, they could just be made easily. Old shop ledgers and utensils have been found in city excavations.
Yeah.
So
very cool.
Stay. All right. Well, with that, the pie episode is over. But Rachel has one surprise. No,
the pie episode is not over.
One surprise factoid here. This should go in a bonus segment for members. While Rachel's looking that up, join our membership and get access to our newsletter and other events that we have that are recorded on our website.
For sure.
ArcPundit.com/members.
So I thought that I had heard a different definition for the word pie, P-Y-E instead of P-I-E.
Yeah.
So I kind of went down a little bit of a rabbit hole trying to figure that out. And it wasn't really enough to be its own segment, but I did find one other like definition, which is in medieval England, the pie or P-Y-E, it was not food at all, but it was a liturgical table of rules used by clergy. And the reason they had this like table of rules is because of the movable feast days throughout the year, like Easter, because Easter isn't on the same day every year. It shifts around.
Yeah.
And there are a certain set of rules that they have to follow to figure out what day Easter and the other feast days are going to be. Some old ones that we don't even follow anymore, probably. But they have to have these like complex calendars that follow like the lunar cycles and the church tradition. And it brings all these rules together into the same place. And this pie, as they called it, P-Y-E, was what helped the priests know which prayers, psalms, and ceremonies were appropriate on a given day. Because it wouldn't have just been the feast days too, because there's always like lead ups to these things, you know? So you've got like a really complex set of rules that you're trying to follow. Anyway, they called it the pie. So there's that.
The church ruined good pie by making rules out of it. Yeah, I know. They made it. Good job, church. Yeah.
And one even smaller side note is that in the 15th century, when printing really became a thing, the pie was among the earliest English texts printed because, you know, the clergy people needed this written down. And instead of writing it, they were having it printed, right? But apparently it's a set of rules. So it's like it's got tables and abbreviations and numbers and all kinds of things in it that make it more complicated for printing. And it made it really hard to typeset it. So the printers would dread it. And later on, it became printer slang for a mixed up jumble of type.
Nice.
So pie, P-Y-E can also mean a mixed up like jumble of things.
Okay.
In medieval times. So,
well, yeah. I got to say, talking about the printing press, because every time I hear the word printing press, this is totally random. I think of it. I think of the only joke I remember, and I wasn't even a religious watcher of it because it was before I was even able to watch TV, but the old series MASH.
Oh, I've never really watched that. Seen a couple reruns, that's it.
That's all I saw too. Yeah. I don't think it was on TV when I was like old enough to watch TV. Yeah. But it was on all over the place, and I did see some episodes, but Alan Alda's character was obviously the big comic relief, and he was super funny. He was a doctor. Mm-hmm. But somebody was disparaging Chinese people, and another person said, because they're over in, I think they're in Vietnam.
Vietnam.
And well, somebody said, well, you know, the Chinese are pretty smart. They invented the printing press in 1492, and Alan Alda says, I know, I was in 1491. I didn't sleep a wink. I don't know why I always remember that.
Why? It's not even that good of a joke.
It's just kind of funny. I don't even know if that's the right year. It's somewhere around there, though.
No.
It's the late 1400s, though, did. But yeah. I don't know if that's exactly right.
That's so funny.
Alan Alda.
Oh my gosh.
All right. That's it for pie.
Yep. That's it. I feel like I need to go make a pie now.
Let's do it. All right.
Bye.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to The Archaeology Show. Feel free to comment and view the show notes on the website at www.arcpodnet.com. Find us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at ArcPodNet. Music for this show is called I Wish You Would Look from the band Sea Hero. Again, thanks for listening and have an awesome day. The Archaeology Podcast Network is 10 years old this year. Our executive producer is Ashley Airy. Our social media coordinator is Matilda Siebrecht. And our chief editor is Rachel Roden. The Archaeology Podcast Network was co-founded by Chris Webster and Tristan Boyle in 2014 and is part of Cultural Media and DigTech LLC.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.